From watching and reading American mainstream media over the past 10 days, you'd hardly guess that 9/11 marked not just the 20th anniversary of the bombing of the World Trade Center, but also the 48th anniversary of the U.S.-supported coup in Chile that overthrew the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende and installed the fascist dictator Augusto Pinochet, unleashing a bloodbath against Chile's left and executing and torturing the folk singer Victor Jara. But September 12th of this past week also marked the 44th anniversary of the murder of 30-year-old South African anti-apartheid freedom fighter Stephen Biko, who was tortured to death by an apartheid regime of racial and economic separation that U.S.-based corporations actively profited from and that the U.S. government propped up for decades. In South Africa, the African National Congress, or ANC, led the resistance, which found international support among labor unions, NGOs and grassroots organizations and college students across the world and in the United States, organizing solidarity actions and boycotts. The 1994 election of Nelson Mandela, after decades of struggle, was heralded as the end of apartheid and the beginning of majority rule. As central as some of this history was on college campuses in the U.S. as it was unfolding, and as involved as so many labor unions were in solidarity work at the time, there seems to be far less solidarity work with South Africa today, though in many ways material conditions for Black South Africans are as bad today, if not worse, than they were before apartheid was, at least in theory, officially dismantled. But the fact that the economic condition for the vast majority of Black people in South Africa remains unchanged highlights a long-standing critical debate between the African National Congress and the Black Consciousness Movement, of which Biko was a primary intellectual architect. While the ANC defined apartheid in strictly racial terms, the Black Consciousness Movement, as Hador Eid and Andy Clarno, among others, have noted, quote, Black radicals insisted that the struggle should simultaneously confront the state and the racist capitalist system. Unless racism and capitalism were confronted together, they predicted, post-apartheid South Africa would remain divided and unequal, unquote. The debate also has direct relevance for Palestinian solidarity organizing and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in response to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. Today in South Africa, the top 0.01% owns a higher share of wealth than the bottom 90%, and Black people who inhabit the country's informal or makeshift settlements are disproportionately impacted by lack of access to COVID vaccinations that generate wealth for a tiny global elite. The reality of the limits of liberation in contemporary South Africa was brought home to some of us in Portland's social justice community with the death in July of Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofokeng, who died on July 18th of COVID in the midst of widespread riots. Palesa's adoptive mother, known by the single name Kendall, is a well-loved member of the Portland activist community, a perennial presence at Portland Street Actions as a photographer and as an organizer with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, along with any number of other local groups. They have an MA in English, a PhD in theater. They were a full professor at Smith College before they took a Fulbright to Lesotho before moving to South Africa, where their life and Palesa became inextricably woven together. They met in 1992, the year Palesa turned 7, and 4 years after Nelson Mandela was released after nearly 30 years in prison. If you want to get a sense of the kind of poverty that Palesa was born into, you might search up the Playing for Change re-release of Peter Gabriel's 1987 song Biko. The video is haunting and beautiful. Peter Gabriel, Angelique Kidjo, and Yo-Yo Ma perform, at least virtually, alongside a global ensemble of musicians, singers, and dancers that ranges from Cape Town, South Africa, to Mumbai, to LA, taiko drummers in Little Tokyo, California, perform alongside drummers and dancers from the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe in Nevada. Collectively, they pay tribute to Biko and to the living promise of decolonizing struggles that are inherently and necessarily anti-capitalist, given that the history of capitalism is inextricably rooted in colonial and neocolonial violence. The video opens with the all-Black Cape Town Ensemble singing amid the rubble of an impoverished informal settlement in Guguletu, which, as Kendall noted, looked very much like the settlement where she first encountered Palesa. Oh.
September 77. Or did Elizabeth weather fine? It was business as usual in police room 619. Oh,
business as usual for Pelessa's mother, without access to land or other means of production, meant being driven to the brink as an impoverished sex worker with seven children and no access to reproductive or any other kind of health care. Pelessa would go on to become a healer, who, given a choice between the relative luxury of the United States or the settlements of South Africa, would choose South Africa. Amid riots spurred by hunger and desperation exacerbated by the COVID lockdown, and following the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma, Pelessa died on July 18th in South Africa, leaving behind two children, one 15 and the other just days short of their first birthday. Kendall, speaking about Pelessa.
She was a large, joyful, loud spirit. She was very extroverted and loved to be with people and to connect. And she just was a walking party. She was joy. She was a loud, joyful, huge presence in the world. When she walked in, everybody knew she had walked into the room. But she was born to an impoverished alcoholic sex worker who did not want her. She became a kind of waif. So when I went to Lesotho in 1992 as a Fulbright scholar, I went into the village to start meeting the people, and I noticed this little girl who was always on the margins. And I asked about her, and people said, oh, she's trouble. Don't ask. But then she came to me. She took my hand. She looked into my face, and she just grabbed hold and held on. The first year that I was there, I started sending her to school because she had never been to school. I bought her underwear and clothing and shoes. And I did that for a number of children. It wasn't just her, because for what an American would spend for lunch, you can send a child to school for a year. So, of course, I did that. But the second year I was there, she developed a very high fever and she became unconscious. And her actual birth mother brought her to my door and said, "You bury this one. God wants her to die." So, of course, I took her to the hospital. She had typhoid. They treated her. And when I got her out of the hospital, her mother, she said, "I'm not taking her back." And Pelessa fell on the ground crying, sobbing. And I felt that rejection by her mother so powerfully that I just took her to my house. And I did a lot of work to set her up in a boarding school. And I thought, okay, I'll just pay and I'll go back to America and I'll send money. But during the second year that I was there, when she came home for Easter vacation, she freed a child who had been used for sex, an 8-year-old child who was tied to a bed by her leg. Pelessa, being deeply empathetic, cut her loose, brought her to me and said, "You take care of her too." So again, I did all I could do with the social work people, and there was no space in an orphanage. I finally put the second one in the same boarding school. And after a few months, the nuns told me she's going to die. The little one is so traumatized by what her life has been. So I thought, well, what the hell have I got to do with my life that matters more than this? So I took her and I started procedures to adopt her. And then I thought, well, why not Pelessa too? So, well, she had a little sister who she was very bonded with, who she carried on her back. And I said, what about her? And her mother said, "I'm keeping her. She's my baby." So I took Pelessa, and I feared there would be a problem because of the bond she had with her biological sister. But we lived for the next 4 years in South Africa. And those were the 4 years of Nelson Mandela's term as president. He He actually had 5 years, but I stayed for four of them. I stayed from 92 to 99. That was when I lived in Southern Africa. And in 95, I cannot tell you how excited everybody was. It was the beginning of the new South Africa. It was the end of despair. It was the beginning of what we thought would be equality and was not, sadly. Neocolonialism took over. There became a governing, ruling class of wealthy Black, Indian, and white people, all.
So a kind of multiracial capitalism.
Yeah. Yes. And they just repeated the horrible injustices. I don't blame Mandela for this, although he did let the white people off very easily, which is why they made him such a hero. He let all the white people keep their wealth because they just don't get it. White people were entitled to free education from kindergarten through college in schools that had Olympic-sized swimming pools and every possible technological innovation. Computers, smart boards, everything. And Black children went to school, if at all, they had to pay, and they went to little shack things with no blackboards and no... The inequality was unimaginable to people in America. I mean, we have horrible, horrible inequality, but this was that on steroids. So... She was coming from that kind of background of hunger and despair. And within her class and caste, she was at the bottom because she was an unwanted female child. And yet she had this huge spirit and this beautiful soul and great empathy. I mean, who else would cut another child loose and bring her? How she died. Okay, so I brought her to America with me in 99. She did not like America. It was so shocking to her that people had to make appointments to talk to each other, that people didn't walk in the streets, that they got into cars to get from place to place. The whole individualistic culture of America to her was just anathema. And she missed her little sister horribly. And she dreamed about her little sister. She heard voices of her little sister calling her. So when she was 18 and grown, she chose to go back, and I supported her after she went back. She couldn't find jobs. Finally, she decided she wanted to be a nurse. So I sent her to school. She became what we would call a licensed vocational nurse or a practical nurse. But she made it all the way through the program, and she was so proud. She was so proud of her uniform and being a nurse and being a healer. And she also trained as a traditional healer. So she was a Sangoma as well as a Western healer. But when COVID came, first she got TB from her patients and was treated, but her lungs were damaged. And then she got COVID and she got it in June and she recovered, but she was using breathing equipment. And then she got it again in July. And she could hardly breathe. She sent me voice messages. And there was a whistle in her chest. And you could hear that every breath was labored. So when the Zuma riot started on July 8th, people started burning down grocery stores.
And we're talking about the former president, Jacob Zuma.
Incredibly corrupt. And... because of his corruption, he was asked by his party to step down, and then he was jailed on July 8th. And at that point, there were gangs of Zuma followers who had orchestrated raids of roads, which they did by blowing up trucks. When those riots started by the Zuma people, many other desperately hungry, angry people who have just been sitting with the disappointment of the new South Africa for so many years were furious. And they saw some of the Zuma people looting the grocery stores. And so they thought, well, if they're going to loot the grocery stores, I'm not going to have any food. I better go. So gradually, this rolling movement happened of the people who were hungry, who went into the grocery stores, looted them, and then set them on fire. And if you can imagine hardly being able to breathe in a freezing cold winter when the toxic smoke from the fires entered her little shack where she lived. She could no longer breathe. And she fought for days. She fought to be able to breathe because she had a baby who was just about to be one, and she'd bought her some beautiful first year birthday presents she wanted to present to her. But the smoke, there was no food. Nobody could get food from the 11th of July till after the 18th when she died. There was no food, there was no medicine, and there was this hideous choking smoke, which we know about from the fires last year, that just poisonous smoke. She wanted a vaccine, but she couldn't get it, even though she was a health worker. Only 3% of the people in her country have vaccines. Well, you know who those are. Those are the people with money. So she died. We did have a GoFundMe. It raised $20,000, which is wonderful. This will enable Palesa's biological sister to take care of the children and herself and her children. But nothing will ever, ever, ever mitigate that incredible loss. Those children had a mother who was a giant. She was diagnosed with a lung infection rather than COVID. And other friends I have in South Africa says, yes, that's what they're calling COVID because they don't want the COVID numbers to be high. The real culprit is economic inequality, which is worse in South Africa now than it was before Mandela was elected. And we see it everywhere. You know that it's in Portland. It's the people having to live in the street because of the money hoarding that's going on from the millionaires and the billionaires and the trillionaires. And it is that capitalistic poison that has wrecked the climate and is wrecking the lives of millions of people all over the world. And South Africa is at the cutting edge of that. So it's the poison of capitalism that killed her.
That was the voice of Portland Buddhist Peace Fellowship organizer and photographer Kendall. And we've been speaking about her daughter, Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofokeng, a traditional healer and healthcare worker who died in South Africa in July. Alongside Palesa, we honor today Stephen Biko, anti-apartheid freedom fighter, who was tortured to death on September 16, 1977. We've been reflecting today also on the ongoing impacts of colonial and neocolonial violence in South Africa, the work yet to be done, and the promise and necessity of cross-national decolonizing struggles. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Omal Variety Hour. We're going to play out today with Playing for Change's re-release of Peter Gabriel's 1987 tribute to Stephen Biko. You can't, nobody can do, but you can't.